All right. So translating in Ayurvedic integral psychology. So integral psychology is one of the cutting edge fields of psychology, where it's working with integrating the various schools of psychology and how can we use these different branches together. And I'm presenting an Ayurvedic model to work with the different schools of psychology. I'm using the term translating because it's already there within the structure of Ayurveda. And by understanding the Ayurvedic terminology, we have the potential to utilize the Ayurvedic foundation for this. So the first question, though, that before we go into this is, what is psychology? And often, you know, there's different definitions in the West, and in India, people are trying to translate psychology into Sanskrit as either Manas Chikitsa or Yoga, and you know, or Manas Aroga, all these things. But I want to state that I don't see there being an exact correlation. In the Sanskrit literature, we have psychological material in the realm of Ayurveda and Manas Chikitsa, Yoga Chikitsa, in Jyotish, in Tantra, in Natya Shastra, in music, and even in grammar, we have psychological material. And it's this material that, when it was translated into the European languages, created a revolution and really brought about the philosophy of mind and what we have as psychology today. The first psychologist was the first person to use the term psychologist, to call himself a psychologist, was William Wundt, and in 1879. And he defined psychology as the general principles of the entire experience in its immediately subjective reality. So he said everything that we're experiencing, the general principles of us experiencing, and all of, you know, and how we're, from a subjective perspective, that is psychology. That was his definition. And that's not Manas Chikitsa, and that's more what I like to call a Bhoktra Vidya. Bhoktra means the experiencer. So it's the science of the experiencer. And that's very important for us to understand, when there's not a direct correlation by what is psychology means in the West and all these different branches and concepts in India. So how do we translate between these two systems so that they can work together and we can get the best of both? And there's so much psychological material there that's inherent and implicit, but we need to make it explicit. We need to bring it out in a way. So the first thing, when we want to bring out this inherent aspect of psychology, is language. And I start with this verse from Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where Janaka and Yajnavalka are talking about speech and the foundation of speech. And Yajnavalka says we attend to speech through as prajna. And Janaka asks, what is prajna? And Yajnavalka replies that it is speech itself, and it is through speech, vacha, that we know prajnayate, a friend. So through prajna, we know who a friend is. And this is going to be very important as later as I go into redefining things. And with prajna, it is through speech that we know the Vedas, we know history, mythology, the sciences, Upanishads, mantras. We know people's elucidations and explanations. We know why to do sacrifices and rituals. Everything about this world and the world beyond is known prajna yate, through speech. So this right here, to me, is one of the earliest verses that show that language creates our perception of reality. He's saying that we know everything based upon speech and how that speech, how it's spoken about, frames how we see it. And so to me, Sanskrit was the ideological origin of the modern philosophy of structuralism and social constructionism. And we see it right here in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So it's implicit here, where the German translators of these texts, they made it explicit, and they created structuralism and constructionism. But they did that after reading these texts and understanding what was being meant, and reevaluating the power of language. So looking deeper at language and how language is creating our reality and creating how we perceive things, let's compare two psychological concepts, one, the ego, and two, ahankara. Now, often these two are, ego is considered a translation of ahankara. But there's a big difference. The word ego is a noun, and it's literally a pronoun being used as a noun, but it's a noun that refers to a thing. Where ahankara, it means I maker. It has a verbal root. And so that verbal root is talking about a function. It's a functional concept. It's the thing that's making me I, which is very different than a noun. So right there we have two different realities. English is a noun-based language. And that noun-based language is great for physiology, which in the psychological field means it's great for neurology and behavioralism. If you have a noun-based, you're looking at a thing, reality, then it's great for looking at things like our brain and brain function. But when we look at ahankara as a function is much more of a psychological term. And Sanskrit, therefore, has a power of looking at psychological processes that we don't have in English. In my opinion, where Latin is the language for the physiological sciences, Sanskrit is the language for the psychological sciences. Now, looking at languaging can make or break an idea. And I give a simple story of the discovery of the reflexive nervous system. There's a scientist, Robert White, who in the 1700s, you know, when they were using electricity and he was stimulating nerves and seeing how it moved, and he came up with the theory that the soul in the brain controls the muscles through the sentient principle in the brain. Through the sentient principle in the spine. So the soul was controlling the muscles through this. Now later, there was a guy named, a scientist named Charles Sherrington. And he read everything of Robert White, but he rephrased it and said that the reflex system is the mind communicating like with a telegraph-like system. Now he's considered the founder of the reflexive nervous system. He's with the discoverer of how that works. The other guy got left behind. He's talking about the soul and how the soul and the body is, you know, kind of controlling things. Where here we have somebody who's talking about the mind working like a telegraph system. So this different terminology completely changed. You know, when Sherrington said it, it took off. Everybody started studying it. When White said it, it didn't stick. It wasn't science. It was still in the realm of metaphysics. And so this difference in how things are phrased is really important. And as we're translating Ayurveda into Western terminology, we have to be aware that we can make or break the acceptance of Ayurveda based upon how we translate it. So as we're talking about how we translate it, let's just take a look at where we're getting our translations from. The first Sanskrit dictionary was into Portuguese in 1720, and the two most famous ones, we have Sir Monier Williams' Sanskrit-English Dictionary, which was 1870, and we have the Upte Sanskrit-English Dictionary, which was 1890. So we're using words that were written in the late 1800s. Just to put that into context, the first textbook in America on psychology was written in 1890. At that time period, psychology was electroconvulsive therapy and mesmerism, which is hypnotherapy type stuff, and nature therapy and hydrotherapy. So there was a very undeveloped concept of mind. So when they translated the Sanskrit, when they translate it at a very low level of understanding mind and how a mind functions. Freud and all his philosophy didn't come till 1895 and the 1900s. So these dictionaries were made at a very early level of understanding the mind, and a very dense and outdated Western concept of psychology. So when people use that terminology, it's almost like they're getting stuck in a 1800s concept of reality, and they're not really getting the breakthroughs that we've had in Western in psychology, nor are they fully able to understand the depth of Ayurvedic psychology. So here I bring out three very important words: jnana, vijnana, and prajna. So jnana is our generally understood concept of knowledge. Now, in general, all these words are generally translated as knowledge. One, you know, they give a few other words with them, but they're all, nothing is distinguished more. Prajna, they add wisdom to, but otherwise they're translated relatively the same. When we look at jnana, jnana is rational knowledge. It's knowledge that's been acquired either through words and through books. You know, you can learn it, you can read it on the internet. It's a very gross level of knowledge. When we look at vijnana, the V-I in front, and this is something that you won't find in the dictionaries, the V is giving it, making it a meta-knowledge. It's making it something that's internally acquired through the reflective process. V means other, apart, or away from. And so it's this concept of looking upon the mind as if you're separate from the mind. So it's the mind looking at the mind. So vijnana is this is not rational knowledge in the same way, but it's knowledge that you develop in yourself through practice, through experience, through looking at yourself, through your own inner work and understanding. We also see the vi being used in a meta knowledge term with vichara, which means reflection. Vipassana, which means to discern or distinguish, which is like watching the mind. Vimarsha, which is reflective awareness. So we see that this V, the VI prefix, is very important in the realm of psychology. Then we take the term prajna. And prajna is an important one to understand, and it's the most important. It's what we saw in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and it's what I'm going to go into the most as we discuss everything. And so pra means before, in front of, and gya means knowledge. And so I sometimes translate prajna as felt sense, because it's a term used in modern psychology, but it's a little bit deeper. It's this felt sense wisdom, or the wisdom felt sense of the body. There's one description of it as Rene, the ringing or the movement of prana in the limbs of the body. The Mandukya Upanishad talks about the prajna being in the latent state. It all the prajnas together, and it's this one felt sense, this one knowing, this one wisdom. So prajna, as I define it, is this inherent knowing that you feel in your body. Some people like to say gut sense, and I avoid translating it as gut sense, because gut sense has this concept of it being this dull sense. And so instead of gut being a dull, we want felt sense, or some higher felt sense, this deeper body wisdom, this deeper knowing, where you know, you feel it, you meet somebody. Remember in the beginning it said, it's how you know your friends. So you meet somebody and you get this feeling. You're like, this person's no good. Or, something about this person I like. Like, it's something you feel inside. It's this inner knowing that is visceral. It's not just in the brain, but it's through your whole body-mind system. So taking prajna at that level, when we look at the classical Sanskrit term, prajna parada. Aparada means fault, transgress, mistake, and often it's translated as mistake of the intellect. Sometimes people say mistake of the body's wisdom. So, you know, body's wisdom is sometimes said. When we get that it's this body's deeper felt sense, this felt wisdom in the body, this inner deep body knowing, then when we say that there's a mistake or transgression, you know, the body says, ooh, you know, it's not time for me to eat, I'm not feeling it, and we make ourselves eat anyway. Or we say, I shouldn't really go out now, I'm tired, and we don't listen to that, to the body, and what it's communicating to us. This is prajna parada. It gives a whole new, deeper meaning to it, right? It's not just mistake of the intellect, as if, like, I'm not listening to something I know in my mind, but it's I'm not listening to this deeper wisdom in my full body self. Beautiful, huh? All right, 43. What's my time I gotta be on? We start at
26.
So I'm good. I'm halfway. Perfect. I'm going even faster than I need to. Which means I can slow down a little bit there.
I have 13 minutes left.
13 only?
Yeah.
Okay. So in the realm of psychology, there's three competing schools. And here I said modalities. But they're really considered like schools of psychology. And so we have the behavioral school of psychology, which is a very biomechanical model. And this is taught in probably 90% of the universities. Presently, it's the most taught form in the universities. Then we have the psychodynamic model, which is talk therapies using insight, dealing with repressed emotions, internal dialogue. And often, this is either in alternative psychology schools or people go and they go to a specialization school after university to learn psychodynamic techniques. And then we have the humanistic school, which is person-centered therapies. It's experiential and very client-directed. So these three schools have fought with each other for the last probably 70, 80 years. As they've all developed, they each of them tries to say why they're right and the other is wrong. And there's many reasons they want to be the right school, because there's money for funding, money for insurance reimbursement, all kinds of financial reasons to be the one who's right. Now, in the 1960s, there began to be what were called psychotherapy integration. How do we do behavioral psychology and mix in some psychodynamic techniques? Or how can we be humanistic and use, you know, so these people started to try and figure out how are we going to blend them. But all blending so far have been a person in one school trying to blend the others into their particular tradition. And so within how do we blend these, there's become three systems of what they call psychotherapy integration, of how do we mix these. The first is called technical eclecticism. And that means that, you know, you look at a person and you're like, oh, that person needs humanistic psychology. And so you do humanistic. Or you look at the person and you say, oh, they need psychodynamic, and you do psychodynamic. So you're just picking which one, and you're just making a call. Okay, today I'm going to use this with them, tomorrow I'm going to use that with them, or this client I'm only going to treat them in this way. Then we have theoretical integration, where we try and understand how we can blend the theories together, but yet we're still using the technique separately. And then we have assimilative integration, which is a combination of both of the above two. You're blending the theory as well as blending the practices. And I like to think that Ayurveda is in the assimilative paradigm. Ayurveda has a structure where it has a general understanding of mind, body, and how that works. And so with that framework of understanding the mind-body dynamics, we can choose, oh, we're going to use this because this is what's not working. We're going to do this one because this isn't working. So Ayurveda has a framework, a structure of understanding the human being and the mind to be able to assimilate all these psychological theories and practices within itself. Now, some people, right now, the behavioral school is one of the more popular ones, as I said, 90% of the universities, and that's because of something I like to call the myth of evidence-based therapy. And evidence-based therapy is that two studies have shown that if you a manualized practice of that therapy beats placebo. And bottom line is that common factors research has shown that all forms of all schools of psychology do better than placebo and better than nothing. So all forms beat placebo. The only situation is that the behavioral school is better at making a manual where the person comes in and you just do X on day one, Y on day two, Z on day three. So the other schools, they're much more flexible and you have to be more malleable. And so it's harder for them to create that manual. So I call it the myth of evidence-based therapy because all of them will pass that if you don't utilize a manual. Now, the Vedic paradigm has a concept called darshana, or viewpoint. And it's the fact of understanding things from different views. We're looking at things in a different way. And so we have, from the physical level, we have the triplicity of the stula sharira, the physical body, the mental body, sukshma sharira, and the causal body, karna sharira. But from the realm of psychology, we're not using the physical body. We're using the mind. And so there we're coming from a realm of jnana, vijnana, and prajna. These are different levels that the mind is processing information and experience on. The mind is either experience rational knowledge, the mind is either experiences internal reflection and ability to look at itself, or the mind is going to this deep level of how I feel about something and what I need in this deep inner urge. So we have these three viewpoints from the realm of psychology, this triplicity. Now, when we look at cognitive behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy is very much like samskara theory. You do something, it gives a tendency to do it more. It's all about retraining the person and making them do certain actions and behaviors, getting them to look at, why are you doing that? Like, change that thought. So they, on a very conscious level, change that thought because somebody told them that thought didn't work, and then they change that thought and they work on it on a very behavioral level. Now, this is very similar to Sattva Vijaya. And if we look at Sattva Vijaya, Charaka gives us the definition of the repetitive restraining, holding from, or focusing away of the mind from improper objects, meaning, or reasoning. So this is literally the definition of cognitive behavioral therapy. So Sattva Vijaya, instead of translating that as psychology, literally it can be translated as the Ayurvedic model of cognitive behavioral therapy. And as for time, I'm not going to go deeper into that, but you can see that the techniques that they use and the techniques that Ayurveda uses in this realm are completely in alignment with cognitive behavioral therapy. Then we have psychodynamic. And psychodynamic is looking at the dynamics within the psyche. And so this is the realm of Vijnana. It's looking at the person, their feelings, what's going on. It's looking at the intrapsychic structures, the ahankara, the buddhi, the manas, the chitta, and it's seeing where are they not functioning, at what point did they not develop in a healthy way, and how can we work on creating them to be functioning in a healthy way. So it's a very different approach. We're in the realm of Vijnana, not jnana anymore. So from an Ayurvedic realm, we can diagnose which level of mind is not working. And we can give appropriate direction of which type of therapy to use based upon our understanding of the intrapsychic structures and whether that's the issue or whether it's just a behavioral bad habit, bad tendency, samskara cycle that's been created. They're very different. Then we have humanistic psychology, and humanistic psychology is really about listening to the person, getting what's going on for them, feeling what their meaning in life, what they're trying to express but having a hard time expressing. It's really looking at how they're interacting with other people, how they're and so it's looking at this felt sense. What is this inner knowing that they have, and how are they not connecting with that inner knowing? And by not connecting with that deep inner knowing, that deep felt sense, that deep inner guidance, are they taking themselves in the wrong direction in life and thereby suffering? So it's about bringing a person into alignment with what's actually going on with them. So here we see that the humanistic psychology is really focusing on prajna. It's really working on cultivating the person's prajna inside themselves, as well as getting them to be congruent. The key word is congruent. That they're feeling something, and not just a feeling on a manas level of an emotion, but a prajna level of a felt sense. Getting them congruent with that. So we have three different schools of psychology. And with the Ayurvedic model, we have three different ways of looking at the mind and how the mind processes. And looking at which of those levels is not working for the person, where are they out of balance, we have an understanding of what type of therapy we can have them work with, which type of therapist we can coordinate with. So they can get some therapy done and we can treat them on a physical level, or if we are a therapist ourselves, to know, is this the issue that we treat with the person? Or do I need to give them, send them to a person who this is their more specific area of treatment? Now, prajna, this ability to connect with that felt sense, that deeper inner body wisdom, is something the Ayurvedic physician is implicitly always practicing, implicitly listening to. When an Ayurvedic doctor sits with somebody, they have a deep listening of what's actually going on with the person. So Ayurveda implicitly is working on the level of prajna. What I suggest is, in the future, and particularly in the realm of Ayurvedic psychology, really making that explicit. So that we are at all points working on creating that congruence with our clients. And by creating that congruence, we are both guiding them to their mental health as well as helping them tap into their body wisdom, which leads them to their physical health. Hooray.
1 minute left. Perfect.
Woo! All right. That was a mouthful. But it was good. It was good.
Want to turn off the water?
Yeah, let's see. Stop that and... Oh no, it didn't record on that level. Yeah, but I was going to record the video, but it didn't. Aye, aye.